and Czechs, and definitely by governments who, at that time during the World War II and during the World Wars, were most keen on protecting their soldiers who were out on the battlefront. The original flu vaccine, by the way, which billions of us have taken over many decades, is a publicly funded effort which didn't have any intellectual property protection and has been run since the 1970s out of a wonderful network at the WHO in Geneva, which releases two recommendations annually that set out what strains of the flu virus should go in. It's a collaborative effort, 110 countries, governments collaborate. And anyone then can manufacture the vaccine based on their formula. The UN just set out in one of its many complicatedly worded resolutions that they intend every treatment and vaccine for COVID-19 to get to everyone everywhere. That can only happen if the vaccines and treatments can be manufactured by everyone everywhere.
Ahel Prabhalla, we want to thank you so much for being with us, coordinator of the Access IBSA project, authored a piece with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz on patents versus the pandemic, which we will link to, as well as your garden story. We'll find a treatment of coronavirus, but drug companies will decide who gets it.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's governor releases her plan to reopen the state. An Oregon senator calls for a major revamping of the unemployment system. And a young black man's shooting death sparks a national outcry. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 7th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As Oregon reported dozens of new COVID-19 infections today, the governor announced her plan to start reopening the state for business. With more, here's KBOO's Annette Newell.
Today, the Oregon Health Authority reported 70 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, 3 presumptive cases, and 6 new deaths. That brings the total to almost 3,000 Oregonians testing positive for the virus so far. 645 of those have been hospitalized for the disease. As of May 15th, Oregon will take its first steps toward reopening public life and lifting its coronavirus stay-home order, but also changing social and economic interactions across the state. Governor Kate Brown has announced a plan that depends on citizens and businesses complying with and adapting to new restrictions and the ability of local governments and health systems to quickly react to a surge of new cases. This morning, Brown outlined a broad set of policies that her advisors have crafted to navigate the coming months. They include requirements counties will have to meet, a new statewide face mask policy, and conditions for businesses to get up and running. Brown said, quote, "This virus is still very dangerous, and it still poses a great threat. Until there is a vaccine, unfortunately, we will not be going back to life as we knew it, not here in Oregon or, frankly, anywhere." She said large gatherings will remain off-limits, including live sports, concerts, theater, festivals, and conventions, until there is effective prevention and treatment available, through September at least. but things like outdoor recreation, restaurants, shopping malls, breweries, salons, and tattoo parlors could reopen if their counties get approval and they can live with and economically survive under new rules. For the first phase of reopening, each of Oregon's 36 counties can submit plans showing they meet 7 public health criteria. They are declining levels of COVID-19 hospital admissions over a 14-day period, minimum levels of testing and contact tracing capacity, adequate hospital surge capacity, quarantine facilities and personal protection equipment, and sector guidelines from the state to communicate to businesses. The governor's office will determine if those plans pass, and if they do, allow counties to start reopening as early as May 15th for Phase 1, which will last at least 21 days. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Legal questions have risen about Governor Kate Brown's guidelines for reopening businesses after the pandemic, especially when it comes to guidelines for businesses requiring customers to submit to temperature checks, wear masks in stores, and give names and phone numbers so contact tracers can track people down if they made contact with someone who tests positive for the virus. So can the governor tell restaurants to take customers' temperatures? Probably, according to lawyers who spoke with Willamette Week. Stephen Wilker, a Portland lawyer, says he believes it is within Brown's power to require businesses to conduct temperature checks, require masks, and collect data about customers. According to the ACLU, the government can restrict people's liberties in a time of pandemic, but if it can do things in a way that doesn't infringe on their freedoms, it should. Beth Creighton, a civil rights lawyer in Portland, tells Willamette Week that the governor's executive powers stop where the U.S. Constitution's Interstate Commerce Clause begins. She believes it could be challenged because it affects commerce. What lawyers all agree on is that any executive orders need to be grounded in public health and be directly related to the pandemic, or the governor could be overstepping. Starting this week, vehicle access to neighborhood greenway streets in Portland will be limited to create more room for social distancing between pedestrians and bicyclists. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Melissa Hood.
Transportation Commissioner Chloe Udaley's office announced the Slow Streets, Safe Streets program last week. Barrels and signs will be installed at the first intersection by the Portland Bureau of Transportation today. Some neighborhood greenway streets have already been designated as a way to encourage bicyclists to use them instead of busier streets. The Bureau said in an announcement on May 1st that PBOT will set up temporary barricades to close streets to all but local traffic and install signs to alert drivers of the priority of people walking and biking on greenways. Pedestrian space along busy streets will be expanded, and more space will be reserved for customers to line up outside of Portland's businesses. The Slow Streets, Safe Streets program will remain in place for as long as Governor Kate Brown's stay-home order is active. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
The first Oregonian to test positive for COVID-19 was discharged from the hospital on Monday. Hector Calderon, who works as a janitor at Forest Hills Elementary School in Lake Oswego, spent over 2 months in Kaiser Permanente's West Side Medical Center. He tested positive for the virus in late February. During his treatment, Calderon was sedated and intubated. A mariachi band and parade welcomed Calderon outside of the hospital as he was discharged, celebrating his recovery. According to officials, Calderon was the second known person in the U.S. to have contracted the virus through community spread and was among the first nationally to be treated with the drug remdesivir. Calderon said to the Forest Hills Elementary community, quote, "I would just like to let you know I miss you so much. Thank you for your support to me and my family." He has been moved to a nursing facility to continue with recovery and physical therapy. Today, members of Oregon's congressional delegation called on other national lawmakers to address the barriers and outcomes that Latinx and immigrant communities are facing as they try to access healthcare services and economic relief during the COVID-19 pandemic. In Oregon, Latinx people comprise more than 29% of the confirmed COVID-19 cases in the state, more than twice their population of 13%, and about 6% of Washington County's Hispanic or Latinx community members testing positive are frontline workers in healthcare, agricultural and outdoor labor, factory and warehouse work, and groceries and food service, Members of Congress say the public health crisis has exposed deep inequities. They say millions of immigrants and their families have been left out of relief efforts, and they've included specific ways to help, including expanded eligibility for stimulus payments, increased access to COVID-19 testing and treatment, improved language access, and more supplies of personal protective equipment. Before Friday's jobs report comes out, Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden outlined his proposal to automatically extend federal unemployment insurance based on economic conditions. Here's what he had to say.
We learned in the Finance Committee rooms that the unemployment system created in the 1930s needs a remodel for a different century. Our goal has always been 100% wage replacement as true unemployment insurance. I will tell you, I'm expecting a jobs report like any I've seen in my lifetime. Already more than 33 million Americans have lost their jobs in the last 6 weeks, and the unemployment rate is going to dwarf what was seen at the height of the Great Recession in 2009. The president is back on a happy talk program and essentially denying so frequently that the pandemic is even a major crisis. But the bottom line is clear. The pandemic is getting worse in several large areas of the country. Testing is still way too low. And Americans are still understandably terrified as thousands of people die every day. The economy is, of course, driven by the consumer, something like two-thirds of the economy driven by the consumer. And so what I've just described is a recipe for sustained economic trouble. Now, even before the president decided his plan is just to pack it in, CBO projected that without additional stimulus, the unemployment rate could be 9.5% at the end of 2021. That's the Congressional Budget Office, of course, the agency that the Congress looks to for good data. And there, of course, have been some estimates that the unemployment rate is going to cross 20% in the months ahead. But my view is Congress shouldn't allow American families to experience that level of unnecessary financial pain and suffering without a helping hand. So in the next coronavirus relief package, I'm pushing for economic triggers so that programs like unemployment insurance can run on autopilot for the duration of this pandemic. My concern is if the president loses the election, Mitch McConnell may just rerun the Obama-era playbook and refuse to support even a penny of additional stimulus. They've already indicated publicly that's the direction they're going. And certainly Republicans benefited politically in 2010 when they said they'd accepted Americans' additional financial pain. And there is, in my view, no reason to think that wouldn't happen again. You already see some evidence of dusting off the playbook, posing additional help for families unless companies owned by supporters are immune from legal liability for exposing their workers to a deadly virus. Donald Trump, of course, wants big tax cuts for big, profitable corporations and their CEOs, hardly the people who need help the most. So the only way for Democrats to be in a strong position to prevent this kind of economic sabotage in 2021 and ensure families aren't used as political pawns is to push for approaches like what I advocate today, triggers tied to economic conditions now. The $600 boost in unemployment insurance benefit, that's the program that I negotiated with the administration down in the Finance Committee room, expires at the end of July, and the plus-up in benefits should continue based on the state of the economy. As the state's unemployment rate falls, the boost in benefits would reflect that. It would fall as well. I'm proposing that the country continue the $600 boost until a state's unemployment rate falls below 11%. The federal boost would fall to $500 at 10% unemployment, $400 at 9% unemployment, $300 at 8% unemployment, $200 at 7% unemployment, and $100 at 6% unemployment. This ensures that you have a phased-in approach and increased benefits don't disappear overnight. 13-week extension of benefits would continue through March 2021 if the state's unemployment rate exceeds 8.5%. 52 weeks of additional benefits would be available, down to 26 weeks of additional benefits at 6.5%. My sense is you all have this in front of you, so just another couple of comments. If the economy reopens, and I put that in quotes, without large events, restaurants operating at, say, 25% capacity, and lots of businesses still shuttered, unemployment is going to remain at historically high levels for months and maybe even years. Workers wouldn't be able to just go back to the jobs they once had. And whether those workers can pay the rent, put food on the table, pay medical bills, should not depend on the short-term political calculations which McConnell is well known for. This proposal, by the way, is just one piece that Democrats will be pushing with respect to regard to unemployment insurance. As a ranking Democrat in the Finance Committee, I'm working on additional proposals. I do think that the economic trigger that I'm talking about for this period can be a model for future periods, and I look also to develop proposals to expand work-sharing program, provide benefits for students, strengthen the pandemic unemployment, you know, assistance program. And by the way, if I was Secretary Scalia, I would be on the phone every single day to the 20 states that still haven't gotten that pandemic set of benefits out to people and say, what can I do to help? I mean, he has basically been AWOL when it comes to these issues of really standing up vigorously for workers.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. Organizers of the Washington County Fair announced today that they will cancel the event this year. The fair, which was scheduled to be held July 24th through August 2nd, won't be held until 2021. The announcement comes after cancellations of other large-scale Oregon events, including the Waterfront Blues Festival, the St. Paul Rodeo, and Seaside's 4th of July celebration. Fair Board President Gary Seidel said in a statement that the decision was made with the well-being of the community in mind, and said, quote, there are too many unknowns related to keeping the community safe right now, and what might be allowed in relation to mass gatherings, and how that could impact an event on the scale of our fair. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Mike Schmidt, a candidate for Multnomah County District Attorney. At 6, we'll hear Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather will be clear skies and a low near 55. Tomorrow's weather, we'll see a high of 82 and it'll be sunny. Today in history, on this date in 1994, Norway's most famous painting, The Scream by Edvard Munch, was recovered almost 3 months after it was stolen from an Oslo museum. Four men were later convicted of the theft. The quote of the day is from artist Edvard Munch, who said, quote, without anxiety and illness, I should have been like a ship without a rudder. A Georgia family demands answers after a black man was shot and killed while he was out for a daytime jog. 25-year-old Ahmad Aubrey was jogging in a neighborhood in Brunswick, Georgia, when a retired district attorney investigator, 64-year-old Gregory McMichael, and his 34-year-old son Travis blocked him with their truck. Then Travis got out of the truck with a shotgun and got into a scuffle with Aubrey as he tried to get away. Video shows McMichael shot Aubrey with a revolver while standing in the truck bed. Later, he claimed Aubrey had violently attacked his son. A shot from the gun struck Aubrey in his abdomen, and a police report says he died on the spot, bleeding to death in a matter of minutes. People across the country have been outraged over the murder, caught on video, and demanding justice. Basketball star LeBron James has weighed in, saying, quote, we're literally hunted every day, every time we step foot outside of the comfort of our homes. A district attorney says he wants a grand jury to decide whether to press charges against the McMichaels. With courts in Georgia closed until at least June 12th due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the McMichaels could avoid prosecution for several more weeks. Foreign interference is still a huge concern for election security experts. That's on top of coronavirus safety concerns in primaries, special elections, and November's general election. With more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
There's no indication that foreign actors are slowing down their efforts to try and interfere in the 2020 election cycle.
David Levine with the Bipartisan Alliance for Securing Democracy is concerned about states' abilities to safely and securely conduct elections this year.
Russia, for example, engaged in some disinformation efforts around the Iowa caucuses. We know that the Department of Homeland Security, as well as a number of other federal and intelligence agencies, put out a statement at the end of last year indicating that Russia, China, Iran, and others will try and interfere in the 2020 election cycle. And there's been no indication, even in light of COVID-19, that there's been any change.
Election security is a priority for America's intelligence community, and it's the Director of National Intelligence, or the DNI's, job to oversee the 17 spy agencies tasked with preventing foreign interference. The Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee expects to vote next week on whether to advance President Trump's nominee for the director job, Texas Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe. Ratcliffe served on Trump's impeachment defense team. His name was put forward for DNI before, but withdrawn after bipartisan criticism of his qualifications. At the Senate's first hearing with social distancing, Senator Mark Warner, top Democrat on the committee, expressed continued doubts.
I don't see what has changed since last summer when the president decided not to proceed with your nomination over concerns about your inexperience, partisanship, and past statements that seem to embellish your record.
The former director, Joseph McGuire, was reportedly pressured to retire in February after an expert on his staff briefed Congress that Russia was meddling in favor of Trump in 2020. McGuire's one of the half dozen intelligence leaders who've been ousted or resigned under duress in the last year. At the hearing, Ratcliffe walked a fine line, asserting his independence, admitting Russia did try to interfere in the 2016 election, a charge Trump resists, but that the interference didn't change the outcome.
The intelligence I will provide, if confirmed, will not be impacted or altered as a result of outside influence.
All the lawsuits and other changes due to COVID-19 have only expanded the need for election protection, according to Levine from the Alliance for Securing Democracy.
You had postal delays, right? You had concerns about voters being able to choose between their health, right, and being able to cast a ballot. And those kinds of situations are opportunities that can be exploited by foreign adversaries to undermine confidence in the integrity of our election process.
In other news, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, recovering from a benign gallbladder condition, joined the other justices from a Baltimore hospital to hear arguments on the White House effort to allow employers to cut out contraception in healthcare coverage for religious or moral objections. And Biden scored two major endorsements, former Attorney General Eric Holder and leading LGBTQ group Human Rights Campaign. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A member of the U.S. Navy who serves as a personal valet for President Donald Trump has tested positive for COVID-19. Valets work on the White House campus and often work closely with the president and his first family. A Defense Department spokesman said, quote, "As with any other service member who tests positive, the individual will quarantine in their residence and will receive medical care as needed." A White House spokesman said today that Trump and Vice President Mike Pence have since tested negative for the virus. Trump said he had little contact with that particular valet staffer, but told reporters he will now be tested daily. The CDC has stated that people who have been in close contact with a person with COVID-19 should stay home and monitor their health, quarantine for 14 days after exposure, and check their temperature twice a day and watch for symptoms. The White House did not say whether Trump will be following these guidelines after his valet tested positive. After a significant waiting period, Native tribes are beginning to receive federal COVID aid. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes across the country are starting to receive payments from the $8 billion set aside for tribes in the CARES Act. The funds were delayed from going out in late April. The Treasury and Interior Departments on Tuesday announced plans to begin disbursement of relief aid to tribes, which includes holding back payments to Alaska Native corporations due to pending litigation. The Ho-Chunk Nation was notified Wednesday it received multi-million dollar funding. The Wisconsin tribe applied for the funds in March to respond to the public health emergency. The Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians received more than $37 million. The Navajo Nation confirmed Wednesday it received $600 million in funding. The funds are to be used for medical needs and public health measures such as food delivery and distant learning. 60% of the $8 billion is being dispersed to tribes. Meanwhile, the state of New Mexico recently launched a task force to address COVID-19 on the Navajo Nation. Members include health professionals, policy experts, and former military law enforcement personnel. Kevin Washburn, law school dean and former U.S. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, is a member of the task force.
There's just so many different facets of the problem. There's what is the medical response? How do you know, what's the testing? What's the contact tracing? How do you manage the cases? And then there are the facilities issues. What, you know, do we have bed space? Do we have quarantine space? How do people get from here to there? And, you know, transportation between sites and that sort of thing. Then there's all the humanitarian issues. You know, water distribution at Navajo is a challenge. And, you know, do people have PPE? You know, public education is an issue because, you know, we're all struggling to understand this. There's still a digital divide in the Navajo Nation. And so those are some of the different issues that are being addressed by the teams and the subgroups of the team.
The teams working with the Navajo Nation, the governor's office, and the state's departments of health and Indian affairs to develop strategies to limit the spread of COVID-19 and ensure the tribal response is a priority. Navajo leaders welcomed the effort. As of Wednesday, the number of positive COVID-19 cases for the Navajo Nation reached 2,654 and 85 deaths. Many Native artists have lost income due to COVID-19, but they have not stopped creating. China Lockett talks with a Pine Ridge, South Dakota-based Lakota artist.
Native American tribes across the country used to warp rawhide into containers, then decorate the outside with color pigments from nature. The traditional work is called parfletch art. Sean Espinoza has been working with the medium for years. In the warmer season, Espinoza sometimes prepares and processes the animal hides himself. The rest of the time, he'll purchase processed hides. Then he cuts out the shapes he needs and binds them together. He finishes boxes and pouches with colorful painted geometric shapes.
I try to maintain the old methods, but I throw in modern techniques as well because I do believe, you know, if the Lakotas had acrylic paint back in the day, which is what I used, that they would have utilized it.
He says parfletch bags and boxes were used to transfer food, clothing, and ceremonial items, and they're built to last.
The ones they show in the museums, you know, they look all battered and beaten and old. You know, it's because they were out in the weather and in battles. You know, they got trampled on by soldiers' horses.
Businesses purchase his work to sell to tourists in the summer months. Right now, many of those buyers are closed, and his income depends on the sales he can make to individuals.
I wish sales were better right now, but yeah, they're really bleak right now. But it's enough to get by, you know, and that's pretty much the story of my career is, you know, providing for my family, even in the most dire situations.
Many other artists are in the same position right now, hoping to make just enough to get by. I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 7th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Melissa Hood and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, where we'll be speaking with Mike Schmidt, a candidate for Multnomah County District Attorney.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today we are virtually sitting down with Mike Schmidt. Mike has previously worked in the DA's office with former Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schrunk. He is currently the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, an organizing body that serves as the policy development forum for state and local criminal justice systems. He is Vice President of the National Criminal Justice Association and serves on the board of the National Association of Sentencing Commissions. Now he is running for Multnomah County District Attorney, a position that puts him in charge of deciding who gets charged with a crime and who doesn't, as well as the severity of the charge. He is running against Ethan Knight, who was recently graded a D by the organization Oregon DA for the People. Mike has been endorsed by the Oregonian, Willamette Week, Kate Brown, and various unions and justice organizations across Oregon. There are less than 2 weeks until the May 19th election. Mike Schmidt, welcome and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Natalie. Glad to be here.
I think something most people don't know is the district attorney is the most powerful position in the criminal justice system. What inspired you to run for DA?
Yeah, I think you're right. Even throughout this campaign, I've encountered many voters, and when I tell them I'm running for district attorney, they're not sure what the job entails, if that's like a public defender type role. Why I want to run for DA is because I believe we need major reform now in our criminal justice system. I have been in the district attorney's office. I did that work. I was there from 2007 to 2013, handled felony cases, misdemeanor cases, did drug courts. And while I felt like I was helping people and doing some good work individually, I didn't feel like I was changing or fixing the system. So I got out, went to the legislature, and then, as you mentioned, have been at the Criminal Justice Commission since, which is a statewide state agency that works on making our criminal justice system more efficient, more effective, more legitimate. And so I've seen firsthand that using data and using research that we can get better outcomes than what we're currently getting in our system, that we're over-reliant on incarceration, and that we can actually improve public safety and use less incarceration at the same time. So when I saw the opportunity to run to be the district attorney in Multnomah County, the person who does get to decide what people are charged with and what sentences to advocate for and seek, I thought having a person who's both been in the office but then left and worked on criminal justice reform issues for the last 6 years of my career, that this was just a very unique opportunity and one where I could have a big impact.
As director of the Criminal Justice Commission, you already work to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of our criminal justice system. For example, you worked to implement a new statewide justice reinvestment program to decrease recidivism. And you've expressed multiple times the importance of using data to continue to reform the system. What are some strategies that you plan to use as district attorney to help lower the incarceration rate in Oregon?
Yeah. So criminal justice reinvestment is really a program. It was founded in legislation in 2013 that focused on the fact that Oregon's prison population has been increasing now since the voters passed Measure 11 and even a little bit before that, which is our mandatory sentencing scheme. And we were to the place where we were going to have to build a brand new prison just to accommodate our ever increasing numbers of people who are incarcerated. And what we've done for the last 6-7 years now that program's been running is been making investments into local communities, into supervision services, into housing, into treatment, into the things that get at the root causes of why many people end up in the criminal justice system in the first place. And we see that when we evaluate some of these programs, that we actually end up getting better results in terms of less future crimes committed than what we would expect to get if we had just sent those people to prison. So for me, it really is a strategy. It's a public safety strategy that, keeping people in the community but working on the underlying issues can both hold them accountable and keep our communities more safe and save us state resources that can be reinvested into things like our educational system or our healthcare system or, you know, treatment and mental health facilities. So it really is, I think, a good public safety strategy to figure out how we can incarcerate less. But you do have to make sure that you're getting better public safety results, that people are committing less crimes and that they're still held accountable. So I would continue the Justice Reinvestment Program in Multnomah County. I'm a big advocate also for their drug courts and mental health courts and veteran court that they have in this county. So continuing those programs, but I'd also like to look into things that haven't really been pursued in Multnomah County, like restorative justice, and how can we bring restorative justice type programs and policies to an adult population. We have it a little bit in the juvenile population that goes through the criminal justice system, but how can we expand those things into the adult system as well? So I think there's a lot of different policies that the next district attorney has an opportunity to pursue that can help us use less incarceration and continue to get better outcomes than if we were just locking people up.
I think most of us can acknowledge that the prison industrial complex is not an adequate replacement for mental health care. So as DA, how could you work on making sure people with mental health conditions don't get lost in the system?
Yeah, I think this is one of the bigger challenges that we face. I've worked on it in Salem to some extent. In 2019, I worked on legislation called Senate Bill 973 that created a new program that is just now starting to get underway in terms of a grant program called IMPACTS. And the whole idea of IMPACTS was, for the first time, we looked at who is in our jails and we cross-referenced that information with our Medicaid data. And what we saw was that 9% of the people who are booked in a year in Oregon into our jails, 9% of the people take up 30% of all of our jail bookings. And when you look at those same people in terms of their medical data, you see that they are 150% more likely to be in our emergency departments and 650% times more likely than their peers to have co-occurring mental illness and addiction issues. So it's a very high needs population, and we're not serving them. They're just getting booked and released in our jails over and over and over again. So that program that we're working to set up would bring grant funds to counties to try to do innovative wraparound services that are targeting specifically those people who are just cycling in and out and in and out of our systems. That's, you know, for me as a DA, that's going to be one of the things that I'm looking at, again, using the data and the research, and then trying to pursue grant funds that are going to help us actually try to get at the root causes. When I see people who are suffering from mental illness booked into our jails and then being held there for times that are longer than somebody who committed the same crime or is accused of the same crime but doesn't have a mental illness, you know, that's just fundamentally inequitable. And I understand why that happens in our system, but it's not acceptable. And we need to do everything we can to make sure that we're not incarcerating people because they're mentally ill.
Another thing that has been obviously considered inequitable and unfair is cash bail, something that exists in many communities across the country and certainly in Oregon. And you have advocated for ending cash bail, which is a policy that puts additional pressure on marginalized communities. What other systems do you hope to implement instead of cash bail?
You know, if we're going to eliminate cash bail, which I think is absolutely crucial, because as you say rightly, it's inequitable. You know, we essentially right now have a system that if you have money, you don't have to stay in jail pending your charges getting to a court hearing. But if you're poor, you do. That just is fundamentally unfair. The only things that should dictate whether or not you're held in jail before your trial should be, if you were released, are you immediately dangerous to the public and the community? If so, you should stay in jail. If not, you shouldn't. And then secondly, whether or not you would show up again. And if you, you know, if you have a history of failing to appear over and over and over again, then that might be a reasonable reason to hold somebody in jail. But otherwise, you know, whether or not somebody has $500 should have no bearing on whether or not they're held in jail. So it's absolutely crucial that we end that practice that's discriminatory and especially hits communities of color inequitably in Oregon and across the country. To be able to get rid of cash bail, though, we need to invest in more pretrial supervision services. And it's, you know, there are some low-tech solutions, very low cost, things like sending people a text message to remind them that they have court today so that they show up. You know, and then sometimes it's a little bit more intense costs, like ankle bracelets and monitoring, so that we can make sure that, you know, the community is protected while the person is not in custody. So there's a range of things that we can make investments in order to make sure that our community is protected and safe, and also at the same time make sure that we're not discriminating against people just because they don't have the means to bail themselves out.
So a big concern for a lot of our listeners is the presence of ICE in our community. And you have said you don't plan to cooperate with ICE beyond what is legally required. What could ICE ask of you in the future, and where do you intend to draw the line?
You know, what the state of Oregon law currently says is that we are not to use state resources to help federal officials enforce their federal immigration laws. That's a federal obligation and duty, and that's where their resources can be spent. So really, for me, it's that I'm not going to use any of my resources to enforce those laws, and that when ICE, as we've seen recently, is subpoenaing public safety officials for information, that if they don't have that signed by a judge, I would fight those subpoenas as other officials across our community have. And I haven't seen a ruling from a judge on that yet, but I would continue to make sure that we're standing up and not sharing that information. There is publicly available information that anybody, the public, has access to, and ICE, of course, has access to that same information. So it's not about impeding them. That would not be legal, but it is about not using Multnomah County's resources to enforce federal law. As the director of the Criminal Justice Commission, we receive federal Burn JAG grants, is the name of the grant. And those grants, the Trump administration suspended back in 2017, and we fought them in the courts, and we won. And so now they have to continue giving us those grants, even though they say that we are non-compliant and that we are a sanctuary state. So, you know, I have a history of standing up to the Trump administration on this issue and fighting them in court and winning. And I would continue to do that as the district attorney and make sure that I'm using our resources on Multnomah County. And that, you know, I also need to make sure public safety is one of the most important things in my role. And if there are members of our community that are afraid to call the police, or they're afraid to come to the courthouse and testify as a victim of crime or as a witness to crime, that makes all of us less safe. So, you know, creating a space and protecting our immigrant communities is also the right, not only is it the right thing to do, it's good for public safety. It's good for everybody. And so as DA, I want to make sure that those communities know that they can reach out to my office and not fear that I'm going to share that information with immigration, so that we can make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect not only them, but our entire community.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners today?
You know, I think the last thing that probably bears saying is that this is a real unique opportunity. It's unique here in Multnomah County, and it's really unique in our state and nationally. District attorneys' offices are rarely in contested elections. In Multnomah County, we have not had a contested DA race for at least four decades. Mike Shrunk took over as the DA in 1981, and I don't even believe he was contested in that race. So this is the first time in almost 40 years that Multnomah County voters have been asked to weigh in on what would they like to see their top criminal justice official, how would they like them to shape our criminal justice system. So it really is just an amazing opportunity to have a conversation about issues that are the public rarely gets to weigh in on. I hope that people really learn as much as they can, go to our website, find us on social media, and learn as much as you can, and then share that information with your neighbors, because this is really a pretty awesome and unique opportunity.
We've been speaking with Mike Schmidt, who is running for Multnomah County District Attorney. The election is coming up May 19th, and you can find more information about his platform online at mikeschmidtforda.com. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Nat Moon.
We are joined on the line now by Daniel Kovalik, who is a human rights lawyer, author of the newly released book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and the book, No More War. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could start by telling us about what happened this past Sunday when the Venezuelan government foiled what appears to have been a coup attempt?
Yes. Well, apparently around 2021 individuals entered Venezuela from the Colombian near the Colombian-Venezuela border. They entered by sea, by the Caribbean. Apparently, they were led by Silvercorp USA, a U.S. Mercenary organization based in Florida. Eight individuals involved in that coup were killed, and another 12 or 13 were arrested, including two Americans, two former Special Forces soldiers who fought alongside the founder of Silvercorp USA, Jordan Goudreau. And the one thing the press is not talking about is that they were initially intercepted by fishermen who actually confronted them and then called Venezuelan authorities to put down the coup.
And what's the evidence that the U.S. Government orchestrated this, and what's the direct evidence of U.S. involvement?
Well, there's, I would say, circumstantial evidence. First of all, Mike Pompeo, in trying to deny U.S. involvement, he said there's no involvement, he said no direct involvement of the U.S. in that operation, suggesting, of course, that there was indirect involvement. And what is clear is that this Silvercorp USA, which led these operations, signed a contract that's now online. A number of news agencies have published it with Juan Guaido, the person that the U.S. appointed to be the new leader of Venezuela. Guaido offered millions of dollars to Silvercorp USA to kidnap and Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, and bring him to the U.S. So there's a few interesting facts about that. First of all, the monies that Guaido promised would have come from the United States because they came from the millions of dollars given to Guaido out of the funds, Venezuelan government funds that the U.S. has seized in the United States, freezed and seized, and then given to Guaido. So that money certainly indirectly came from the U.S. In addition, there's no way that these folks, had they been successful in bringing kidnapping Maduro and bringing him to the U.S., there's no way they could do that without U.S. government permission. You know, they take a sitting head of state and bring him to the U.S. I mean, they would have had to have government, U.S. government support. Finally, what I would say is that, you know, a few weeks ago, Donald Trump put a bounty on President Maduro's head, a $15 million bounty for anyone who would arrest him. And clearly, these folks were thinking that they were going to arrest him, bring him to the U.S. and get the $15 million bounty. So, you know, there's a lot of fingerprints here of the U.S. on this. I think more details need to come out, but I think they will show that the U.S. ultimately was behind this.
And I understand two of the people that were arrested in this attempted invasion by boat were former Green Berets that are U.S. citizen, Luke Denman and Aaron Berry, that are now in prison in Venezuela?
Yes, that is very clear. And again, they both worked for Silvercorp USA based in the United States. Silvercorp USA was actually tweeting about the operations. You know, they've been very open that they were behind this, that they were doing it to take Maduro down. They were doing it under contract with, you know, the U.S.'s puppet, Juan Guaido. So we know an awful lot about what happened. And again, the whole thing was hatched certainly in Florida, if not in Washington, D.C.
One of the things that the U.S. has been criticized for during this COVID-19 crisis is maintaining and expanding the sanctions on both Venezuela and Iran. Can you talk a little bit about that and the impact that those sanctions are having in Venezuela during this time?
Yes, well, we know these sanctions are deadly. There was a recent report done actually last year in 2019 by the Center for Economic Policy Research, which showed they estimated over 40,000 Venezuelans died in a one-year period between 2017 and 2018 due to the sanctions, and they based that on the medicines that Venezuela cannot get because of the sanctions, which includes HIV medicines, chemotherapy medicines, insulin, dialysis equipment. And based on that and the number of people who need those medicines to survive, they estimated 40,000 Venezuelans died in that one-year period, and that would, and that even more than 40,000 would die in the upcoming year, 2019, which we're still waiting for data on that. The point is, these sanctions are starving countries like Venezuela and Iran and Cuba and Nicaragua of life-saving medicines, of respirators. In the case of Cuba, we know that the U.S. has prevented respirators from getting there during a pandemic. And so the U.S. is intentionally hampering these countries' healthcare systems during a pandemic, killing tens of thousands of people. I mean, it's quite unconscionable.
And does the current situation with the putting a bounty on the head of Maduro, who is the head of state there in Venezuela, appear to be trying to use this pandemic as a cover to, again, overthrow the government of Venezuela, as they've tried to do multiple times?
Absolutely, because not only did Trump put a bounty on Maduro's head, he also sent warships to the coast of Venezuela during this pandemic. He has openly stated that Venezuela should be ready for a surprise, you know, in terms of efforts, increased efforts to overthrow Maduro. So all of this appears to be a part of a plan to increase pressure on Venezuela during the pandemic to destabilize the sovereign country in Venezuela during a pandemic, which is already destabilizing countries around the world. I mean, it's hard to fathom, really. And this has been denounced by the United Nations, by the Pope, by numerous human rights organizations, which are just saying, you know, you cannot do this sort of thing, especially during a world health crisis.
Well, and I wonder if you could just talk a little more about this bounty that the U.S. has put on Nicolas Maduro's head, saying that he is somehow involved in drug trafficking. What's their basis for that? Is there a basis for it?
There is no basis. In fact, I would urge people to go see a report by the Washington Office on Latin America, which is not – it's a human rights group, which has been pretty tough on the Maduro administration. But they did a recent report based on the U.S.'s own data showing that Venezuela is not a significant traffic point for drugs, especially cocaine, coming out of South America. And they concluded that these claims against Maduro were simply falsified. Meanwhile, the U.S.'s closest ally in the region, Colombia, provides the U.S. with about 94% of its cocaine, you know, and that doesn't stop the U.S. from militarily, politically, and economically supporting that country. So this is clearly a fabricated pretext for regime change.
And what is the situation in Venezuela with the coronavirus? I know there was, after the first case on March 26th, there was a national quarantine imposed. Is that still in place?
It is. And because Venezuela quickly responded to this crisis, unlike the United States, which, as we know, took at least 6 weeks to respond to, Venezuela, even despite U.S. sanctions, even despite the pressure, is doing better than any country in the region to deal with this crisis. The last I looked over the weekend, the last statistics I saw were that you had about 350 people who have tested positive for coronavirus in Venezuela, and there were 10 deaths up to that point. Very small numbers. And it's because the Venezuelan government acted quickly, even before the first positive case, to try to get on top of this pandemic. Frankly, we could probably learn a lot from them and how to handle this crisis.
And what's the role of the media in maintaining that national quarantine? I understand the state media has been ensuring that they continue the coverage of this pandemic and warn people about staying home. Are there other measures that are being taken other than just notifying people via the media?
Well, it is a voluntary stay-home measure, first of all. But they have local community organizations trying to urge people to stay at home. And as I understand it, about 90% of the population is abiding by that and staying at home. And you have the leaders of Venezuela, including Nicolas Maduro himself, who go on air with face masks on, you know, unlike Donald Trump, who won't wear a mask, who actually went to a mask producing company yesterday without wearing a mask. Maduro and his cabinet always go on TV with a mask to urge people to do that.
And the economy there, I know there's a large dependency on oil exports. How is that impacted by the current world economic situation, especially with the reduction in oil prices?
Well, because of the U.S. sanctions and because of the incredible drop in oil prices, the economy is in a very difficult situation there. There's no question about that. But the amazing thing that Venezuela is showing is that even in a bad economic situation, that if the people pull together and work towards, public health outcomes, they can be successful, and that is the case here. So even though the economy is under amazing strain, the Venezuelan government is finding a way to get health care to people, to get food to people, and they should be applauded for that.
Just before this crisis hit, there was a power crisis, and the U.S. support for Juan Guaido, as you mentioned, is and now they're attempting to carry out paramilitary coups, or someone is attempting to carry out a paramilitary coup. What's the current status of the Maduro government? Is there any election planned? Is Juan Guaido trying to take power in the midst of this?
Well, Juan Guaido is trying to take power. Obviously, he signed this contract with these mercenaries to try to seize power, but he doesn't have popular support. Meanwhile, the Maduro government is in talks with the more moderate sectors of the opposition to build national reconciliation. These talks include plans for legislative elections in the upcoming year, and they are talking about presidential elections as well. So, and again, that is not getting much attention, but there is a moderate opposition that is in dialogue with the Maduro government. And I think there will be legislative elections, certainly within the next year as a consequence. And much of the opposition has turned on Juan Guaido. They see him as an upstart. They see him as a lackey of the United States. And he's become an embarrassment, truthfully. And after this failed coup, I think any political capital he had left is just gone.
Well, I think we have to leave it there. I really want to thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking with Dan Kovalik, who is a human rights lawyer, author of the recently released book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and the new book, No More War. Thank you, Dan Kovalik, for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
Open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm.